Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting, broadcasting, broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world, to the world, to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk Radio.
Organs
become weaker and weaker and weaker. And what happens is at birth, the baby generally has 2 to 4 times the organ capacity needed to sustain life. And generally in midlife, 20s, 30s, 40s, people have about twice the organ capacity they need to live. By the time a person is, say, 65 or older, they generally have just about what they need to live. One of their organs might be operating at less than what's necessary to sustain life. For example, maybe one kidney or both kidneys might be not doing what they're supposed to be doing, but the skin or the lungs are kind of working a little harder to pick up the slack. The person has a lesser activity level. So all these things create a new balance that allows the person to live. And so what happens then is for an elderly person, the minimum lethal dose becomes a lot lower than what it would be, say, for a younger person. And the death rate then is much higher than what's expected or what people believe to be the case, even doctors, in a younger person. So a doctor can take a drug, prescribe it as directed, and in an older person, it's more likely to result in death just because of this biological progression. And so an example of this is when I was in residency, there's a routine practice in hospitals. And when a person's admitted to the hospital, just to make the nurse's job a lot easier, the doctor has to write routine orders for sleep medication. Well, it's just generally a sleeping pill, like Ambien or Halcyon or whatever. So routine sleep medication, routine pain medication, which is usually Tylenol, but can be something like aspirin or an arthritis pill the person is taking at home, and routine prescription for indigestion. All of these drugs are written routinely to be given at the discretion of the nurse, or just whenever. So there's no particular obligation to give this or prevention from giving it. The doctor will generally, being a good doctor, a capable doctor, standard of care, recommend a certain amount, a certain limit or frequency of duration, and that's the story. Well, the reality of this is if you give the person the indigestion antacid, then that's going to make any parasites in the stomach more robust and spread throughout the person's body. So that's the indigestion medication. The pain medications, all of them without exception, decrease the function of the liver and kidney. And then you have, of course, the sleeping pill, which puts the person to sleep never to wake up again. So these are the three medications doctors, a competent good doctor, will write for every patient when they come to the hospital. So let's wind it back the year 1983. And I was a resident, and I was in the emergency room. We were admitting patients, and there was this lady who was admitted. She was 90-something years old, early 90s, like 92. And she was just extremely talkative. She had opinions about everything. I want this done. I don't want that done. And she was telling her family this and telling them that. And, you know, just really very animated energy. And the family was concerned, you know, because mom had whatever the problem was. I wasn't her direct doctor. Another one of my colleagues who was also in training was her doctor. And so he felt, probably like the rest of us did, that she just had a little too much energy. So he could give her a sleeping pill on the spot. So what she did. Now, the other thing in the elderly is medicines have what's called a paradoxical effect. That means when you give an old person who's not accustomed to medications a sleeping pill, they can often become agitated instead of becoming more sleepy. And that's what happened. She became agitated. And so she, later on that night, just around 11 p.m., it was clear that she had not yet relaxed. And so then the nurse gave a second dose, and by morning she was dead. And this is actually a pretty routine event in hospitals. And because of the standard of care, doctors who don't write these routine orders are considered to be deficient, are considered to be actually negligent. And the nurses let you give you a call. Say, doctor, you didn't write standing orders for sleep, pain, and indigestion. And so we have this standard practice, and it's actually rather deadly. But it's, again, dosing of the elderly. This is something that affects elderly people more so than younger people, say 50-something. Why? Because a 50-something person has a greater level of function of their vital organs and can tolerate a lot of these drugs a lot better. So, what evidence do we have that this is killing Americans prematurely? Well, the Health and Human Services has done a very nice report, 2010, and it said our usual, of course, .gov website, and it says, in summary, 13.5% of Medicare patients experience harm during their hospital stay. An additional 13.5% experience temporary harm during their stay. So 13.5% experience permanent harm, and another 13.5% experience temporary harm. If you add it up, 27% of all hospital admissions result in harm to the Medicare patient. And they attribute 15,000 deaths every month to this harmful hospital care. That would be 180,000 deaths a year of the elderly as a result of hospital care they receive that is paid for by the Medicare program. This is an incredible concept because Medicare highly, highly, highly regulates hospitals. And so it's difficult to attribute, to not attribute some of this death to regulations of Medicare. So what is the government's involvement in this harm? Well, first of all, they're paying for it. That's pretty obvious if you ask me. They're paying for it. I mean, if you don't want something, don't pay for it. They could at least reduce reimbursement when patients are harmed and withhold reimbursement when patients die. That would be the least they could do, but that's not what they're doing. So here's what the Medicare people found. This is the Department of Health and Human Services, Mr. Levinson. Even after hospitals investigate preventable injuries and infections that have been reported, they rarely change their practices to prevent repetition of the adverse event. Now, that's shocking. So the government is aware that hospitals are investigating preventable injuries, yet continuing the very policies that created the injury. And so the report itself indicates the government is certainly aware of the harm. Now, what else does Mr. Levinson say? He says, hospital staff did not report most events that harmed Medicare beneficiaries. Indeed. He said some of the most serious problems, including some that caused patients to die, were not reported. And so, federal investigations, you know, looking into this, and they're not coming up with a whole lot. And they did an in-depth review of 293 cases where patients were harmed. And this is very instructive. So 293 cases. Of those, 28 were investigated by the hospital, and only 5 led to changes in policies or practices, the study said. So this is really interesting. Now, even more shocking is that 2,900 hospitals have joined the administration in a partnership for patients intended to reduce errors and save 60,000 lives in 3 years. So of the 180,000 people who are dying every year, the government is instituting a program that it anticipates will only prevent 20,000 of those deaths, not even 12%. Like, why bother? And of course, the government spends $524 billion a year on Medicare, which, as you see, will be a spit in the bucket. Now, this was reported on by the New York Times, which is like standard media, no alternative stuff here. Now, they do say that these are hospital errors, but obviously, how can you call it an error when they failed to investigate 293 of these incidents? And they did investigate 40. They were reported, rather. 40 were reported, only 28 were investigated. And of those 28 they were investigated, only 5 led to policy changes. And we don't even know if those policy changes were effective. So you have to have here, I mean, you have to infer some level of deliberate behavior. This is not just an accident. And so they're calling these errors, and obviously the report says otherwise. Okay, so you're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniel on the Rainbow Soul Channel at PlaceRadio.com. Please visit our sponsor and get your copy of the book, Do You Have the Guts to Be Beautiful? This anti-aging book is available at VitalityCapsules.com/truth-files. And get your copy of Dr. Daniel's book that has helped men and women look and feel 20 years younger. And for a limited time, free shipping. And that's at vitalitycapsules.com/truth-files. And as always, I welcome your calls and questions. Please call in at 914-338-0695. Okay. So, 180,000 elderly people are dying every year, financed by and under the watchful eye of the government. But this is not enough. We need a little faster death rate here. So then there was hospice. Now, hospice was introduced by the feds as a way to save money. It was not introduced to save lives. So the premise of hospice was that in the last year of life, people were consuming a lot of resources. And so what they wanted to do then is create a program that would help / allow people to die in a less costly circumstance. Okay? So no life-saving intent here at all. And so the way it works, the doctor identifies that a person has 6 months to live. At that point, the person can then enter a hospice program, which allows the person to receive services that they would have had at the hospital, either in the comfort of their home or in a less intensive branch of the hospital. And services would be aimed at making the person more comfortable, not at curing them in any way. Okay. So the government's financing a program with the government's conditions are must be dead in 6 months, make no attempt to improve the person's health. And it's very interesting. And so I went to medical school and I practiced medicine, so I can tell you a little bit more inside information, which is doctors don't have the ability to predict who's going to die in 6 months. They might be able to tell you who's going to die in a day, a week, or 2 weeks, or even 1 month. Once you get up in the 6 month mark, you're pretty much, the doctor's estimates are totally unreliable. And so what happens when a doctor says this person has 6 months to live, it amounts to permission to kill. It's like marking a tree with a spray paint white etch, you know, cut this one down. So, but what is the public told? The public is told that hospice is a providing care, especially for the terminally ill. And it's a home that provides this care. And so it's a caring thing, is what the public is told. And so hospice, as we said, for people who are nearing the end of life. Now, this is advertising. This is PR from the internet, from the hospice people, people who are nearing the end of life. And that actually is a disturbing term to apply to care you give to someone who's supposed to die in 6 months. I mean, that is their, they got a deadline here. 6 months, you're supposed to be dead. So that's not nearing the end of life. If you ask me, that is the end of life. And so to provide that kind of care to someone who's nearing the end of life is, again, legalized homicide. So hospice care is provided by a team of health care professionals to maximize the comfort for the terminally ill. Who can benefit from hospice care? Actually, this is the Mayo Clinic site. Mayo Clinic site is visit. Hospice is for terminally ill persons expected to have 6 months or less to live. This doesn't mean that hospice care will be provided only for 6 months. However, hospice care can be provided as long as the person's doctor and hospice care team certify that the condition remains life-limiting. And this is a little misleading. We're going to see later on is that if patients are living too long in hospice, then the government penalizes the hospice. So this is not an open ride, blank check kind of thing. So they're saying hospice is not just for people who have cancer. Many people who receive hospice have cancer, while others have heart disease, dementia, kidney failure, or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And so it's a very glowing experience. The definition of truth is eligible for this beautiful care. Most hospice care is provided at home with a family member typically serving as the primary caregiver. And so this sounds really nice because someone who loves them is there. No matter when hospice care is provided, sometimes it's necessary to be admitted to a hospital. For instance, blah, blah, blah. And so let's look at what really happened. This is San Diego, and this is a New York Times story. And this is actually, you know, pretty typical. Because death sometimes comes slowly at one of the nation's largest and most respected hospices. That's not unusual. But here's a twist. For some patients, it came not at all. When hospices normally treat patients with fewer than 6 months to live, San Diego Hospice often serves people who have much more time left. Now, in the article, the hospice claims these people live longer because we took such great care of them and we really cared for them. And let's take a look at what happened. So Medicare performed a federal audit because their patients were living too long, and said it admitted patients who were too healthy. And so the hospice had to cut 260 workers, discharge 100 patients who didn't seem like they were going to die anytime soon. And in the wake of this ongoing federal audit, they're actually facing bankruptcy. So now what they're doing is they are discharging their patients at 6 months. So they're saying, hey, we're out of here. The other thing that they're doing is they found that the reason patients were living so long is when they came in, they were just as ill as anybody else, but they somehow turned around and did better. And so the government's saying is, hey, that is not allowed. You're supposed to simply allow them to continue to deteriorate. And so it's cracking down on the, Medicare is cracking down the industry's growing habit of embracing those whose death is not imminent. Now, I have to tell you, as a doctor, if a person is going to die in 5 months, their death is not imminent. Imminent death is death that's going to occur in less than 1 month. And so the government, by putting this deadline out there at 6 months, they're saying, we want people who could have lived to not live. And so many hospice programs are being investigated. And the Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General has made these investigations a priority. And there's an ongoing review and assessment of appropriateness of hospice general and patient care claims. A claim is when a bill is submitted to Medicare. And so they found 82% of hospice claims for beneficiaries in nursing facilities did not meet Medicare coverage requirements. So it's not clear here if they're blurring the lines between a nursing facility and a hospice. But the point is that the government is very strict about this. They don't want these people living past their 6 months. And hospice is a booming $14 billion industry. Now, again, it's a $14 billion industry, but the government is spending about $580 billion on Medicare. So this $14 billion piece might actually be saving them, say, $100 billion. Now, again, what the government betrays here is its true motive, which is to make sure that the individual patient actually dies. Now, 1.6 million people in the United States are in hospice. And about 45% of all those who died in 2011 were in hospice. So it's very interesting. And Medicare paid for 84% of those patients. Which means it's actually, they're pretty good. They're getting a pretty good estimate here of people who are dying, or accelerating the death of people who have this difficult to say. Now, the trouble began in this hospice when the federal officers launched this audit in 2010. In a statement responding to this inquiry, because Medicare and Medicaid come under fire for this, because we take seriously our responsibility to safeguard taxpayer dollars from fraud and abuse. working with this facility to ensure that the immediate needs of patients are being met while actively monitoring billing to prevent abuse or fraud. So it's not that the hospice billed for services they did not provide. They did provide the services, but the patients were living too long. And so we see here the true motive. And so what the hospice says is it's a catch-22. Oftentimes these patients have extended prognosis because we've been in there working with them. And this is, again, this is a good hospice. This is a hospice where their patients are actually surviving and doing well. Now, of course, another wrinkle is Medicare pays a set amount each day a patient in hospice. We work from $153 to $896 a day for round-the-clock assistance. This is a fraction of the hospital cost. And so hospices have a difficult time making money during the time-intensive period known when patients first arrive. So they depend on that, those extra days between, say, 2 months and 6 months, where the patients have a lower intensity of care and they can, and the reimbursement is less than their cost, and they can make up what they lost in the first part of the care. So the hospice program then is really a terminal program. And I'm aware of other cases where the person is approaching their 6 month deadline, and the hospice nurse is instructed to leave a lethal dose of medication with the family and to tell the family to give this lethal drug more frequently and more often to be sure to keep the patient comfortable. A lot of times the family doesn't realize that what they're being told to do is give the person a lethal dose. In other words, to exterminate or euthanize their loved one. And so this happens even without the family realizing that they just murdered their loved one. Well, I mean, they don't realize it before. Usually after, they realize, oh my God, the nurse told me to increase the dose of that painkiller. I increased the dose of the painkiller, he was dead in 3 days. And so this is what happens as you approach the six-month point in hospice care. And so entering hospice can actually increase your risk of dying in the following 6 months. And so there needs to be a certain strategy around that to negotiate. And what they found here is in 2011, the Journal of the American Medical Association study found that for-profit hospices, are more likely than their nonprofit counterparts to find ways to avoid enrolling more expensive patients. And so these hospices serving the neediest patients may face difficult financial obstacles to providing appropriate care in this fixed per diem payment system, some said. So Health Affairs, this is an industry journal report, many hospices refuse to accept patients who require expensive types of treatment such as chemotherapy, intravenous feeding, and blood transfusions. So hospices are under federal scrutiny for more than their choice of patients. And so what the government wants to see is it wants to see that death at 6 months. That's very important. And so while Medicare is focusing on the problem of patients who linger in hospice, the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization pointed out that a third of patients only receive hospice care in the last week of their lives. And so, as you can see, the Medicare program, which is saying we don't care what happens, just want them dead by 6 months, and then the Hospice Palliative Care Organization is saying, but wait a minute, we have people who are, dying within a week of arriving. And so the question then is why the pressure? Why is it that the government is so intent on this goal? We've got the Medicare program murdering 180,000 people a year, and now they've got the hospice program, and they're pressuring the hospice to make sure these deaths happen at 6 months. So there's got to be a pretty big motive for this. Well, you know, people say, oh, yeah, some people are just mean, they're mean-spirited, they're hateful, they like to murder people, as possible. But I think There's got to be a dollar bill in here somewhere. So, what is the impact on life expectancy? There's got to be an impact here. It turns out that if you check the government statistics on the census for 2011, you'll see that there's a group of people in the United States who don't get much health care at all. They don't get health care very well. And they live on average 7 years longer than the life expectancy for Americans. We can guess, we can deduce, just from that comparison, this cross-cultural comparison, that the average American's life is shortened by 7 years just due to their impact of the healthcare system. Now, the government knows this. Why do they increase funding for this? Why would the government increase funding for this carnage that it knows is going on? Well, to take a look at this, to understand this, we have to take a look way, way back. We have to look at something called ERISA. What is ERISA? ERISA is the Employment Retirement Insurance Security Act. And this was presented to me at first in business school. And it was hammered home that ERISA created an opportunity in the present and a liability in the future. So what was the opportunity in the present? ERISA, prior to ERISA, companies would put aside money every month for the retirement of their workers. And this is part of their money, part of the workers' money, but this was an obligation that they had made to the employees, saying, hey, you know, we'll pay for your retirement when you retire if you work for us and you put aside this money. And so the employee said, hey, good deal, we'll do it. And so many people are working at jobs they hate, doing things they don't like, with bosses that mistreat them because they're just counting the days to retire, counting the years to retire. So the government decides it needs to regulate these big pots of money, just couldn't let them sit out there. And so what the government said to the companies was, we will now allow you to choose between having a defined contribution plan, where you have to put aside so much money every month, to a defined benefit plan, where you only have to put in enough money to produce a certain benefit that you promise in the future. What does that mean? That means that instead of putting money aside every month, now the business is to say, well, we don't need to put aside any money this month because interest rates are up, yields are up, and the interest on what we've already put aside will more than pay the expected future benefit we promised. So we don't need to put money in this month. And then, of course, the business can go month after month after month saying this. And so what's going to happen then, because the business overestimates the interest rate and overestimates the amount of growth, then the 20 cents they put in this today doesn't turn out to be $200 20 years from now. And the interest, the retirement plans are underfunded. That's one thing. The next thing that happens, obviously, is the business gets to keep more money for the executives and for profit and for whatever else they want to spend it on. And so it allows the company to legally steal the pension of its workers. So it allows the company to make an empty promise. That's one thing that happened with ERISA. What else happened? Well, if ERISA wasn't bad enough, in the 2000s, there was something called backdated stock options for executives. How does this work? You have a pension fund, and the pension fund holds company stock. And it allows the executive to say, I want to buy stock for $50, and then sell it back to the pension fund for $100. And so you have this piece of paper going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. So imagine you and I are standing on a street corner, and I have a piece of paper in my hand. And the rule is, every time I hand it to you, you have to give me $50. Every time you hand it to me, I have to give you $100. That one piece of paper is going to get pretty busy, right? Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, until you have all the money I have, so I'm payless. And that's exactly what happened. And this is why the government had to step in and limit the backdating of stock options. the public at the time, this is in the 2000s, didn't understand what was going on and why it was so important. Or that this, I mean, it seemed unfair to allow executives to buy stock at a discount and sell it and get so much more money for it. What actually happened was they sold it to the pension holders. And that's exactly what happened. So then, if you have these two things going on, the underfunding up front because you have defined benefit, not a defined obligation to put money aside, then you allow the executives to loot the funds with stock options, then once 20 years passes, what do you have left to pay out? Not a lot. So these are underfunded. So what happened? Well, when ERISA was created, something else was created. It was called the PBGC. That's the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. This is a kind of a government, quasi-government agency. Directors appointed by the President of the United States, and the officers are the Secretary of Labor, Commerce, and Treasury. And so when retirement plans go broke, the government has to step in and is responsible for these retirement benefits. So what has happened is a hot potato has been created by this regulation process for the private businesses. Pension funds have been looted. The responsibility for making good on this has now been passed to the government. We'll call it a hot potato. So now the government is in a position of having to pay this out. Now, why would this be a problem? Why would the government even be interested in doing the right thing or doing anything? Well, first of all, if the government does not pay up on this debt that's coming out, then the system would cause a loss of confidence. It would not be possible to bind and enslave a whole generation of young people into dead-end, low-paying jobs with no future that they hate. Many people actually count on the value of benefits when they consider a job. And many people actually count on retirement benefits as a motivation that keeps them in their job. So this real issue then is that the exposure of, I would call it a Ponzi scheme, but they're not even keeping enough money to call it a Ponzi scheme. The inability to deliver on its promise would be exposed, and control of a whole generation of slaves would be lost. Now, that's just an awful thing. So how do you keep such a grand theft and Ponzi scheme from being exposed? Simple. Murder the recipients to reduce the payout. Limit the liability. So enter Medicare and Medicaid. You have to put Medicaid in there, even though we think of it as the poor person's program for poor people. Oh, but Medicaid actually pays for a lot of nursing home and hospital care for the elderly as well. And so, as we said before, epidemiological data suggests that life expectancy is shortened by 7 years. And so, let's take a look and see what the impact is. If we look at a recent New York Times article, they indicate that the $1.3 trillion shortfall in pension funds and the ability to pay those funds. So, so what they're saying is the companies in the Standard & Poor's 500 collectively reported that at the end of their most recent fiscal years, their pension plans had obligations of $1.68 trillion. And assets of just $1.3 trillion. The difference, $355 billion, was the largest ever, Standard & Poor's said in the report. Of course, this is only growing. So of the 500 companies, 338 had defined benefit pension plans. That's the kind that I talked about, people where they're not obligated to fund the plan because Santa Claus is coming and interest rates and other good things are going to happen in the future will just make the money mysteriously appear. So 338 of the 500 Fortune 500 companies have defined benefit pension plans where they really don't have a fixed obligation to fund it. And only 18 are fully funded. So 7 companies reported that their plans were underfunded by more than $10 billion, the largest negative figure being $21.6 billion reported by General Electric. And they list a lot of other, I'll just tell you who they are, companies, AT&T, Boeing, Exxon, Mobil, Ford, IBM, Lockheed Martin, J.P. Morgan Chase. Other companies with more than $10 billion in underfunding were...
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry, JP Morgan Chase had a surplus. But Lockheed Martin, IBM, Ford Motor, Exxon, Boeing, AT&T had deficits. They were underfunded. So this is huge. And this amount of money is becoming due and payable immediately. And this is real time. And this obligation is potentially rolling over to the federal government. Now, what's the revenue side here? Where's the government getting its money from? Well, it's taxes, right? Taxes. Well, in 2011, there's $2 trillion paid in tax revenue to the U.S. government. That's nice. $60 billion was collected in taxes for gas. That's nice. But $22 trillion in off-the-books income, potentially, was received via the drug trade. Dr. Daniels, how do you figure that? Well, we have ongoing programs such as, we are aware of, Iran-Contra. We are aware of the Afghan war. We are aware of the increase in heroin opium importation as a result of that war. And so we are aware of ongoing efforts by our government to import drugs into our company and into our country. And also, if you look at the global figures, $36 trillion of the world GDP goes toward the drug trade. $36 trillion. Of that, 67% takes place in the United States. That's $24 trillion of the world's illegal drug trade ends up in the U.S. streets. And through government operations, as I mentioned before, like Iran-Contra, Afghanistan war, and other military and paramilitary operations, the government brings this money in, realizes revenue. Then you have the forfeiture and cash seizure laws, which means they allow the drug dealers, who don't realize what the deal has is going on here, to amass cash and whatever, and then they seize it, which is just basically reducing the government overhead. And so when you take a look at the $2 trillion tax revenue, $22 trillion in off-the-books drug trade, and it becomes very clear that the reason the elderly have to go is because they do not contribute to the government revenue. They don't contribute to the drug trade. In other words, an elderly person at most can spend their whole Medicare check on illegal drugs at best. But you get someone who's in the workforce, who's actively working, there's a whole paycheck there. You're talking the average American earning between $40,000 and $50,000 a year. That's a golden goose you can really fleece. And so an elderly person is not going to be in a position to work overtime to buy illegal drugs or gas to commute back and forth to work that the government can tax. So by and large, people as they approach 65 are not profitable to government. It turns out that the profit ends a lot sooner than that, though, because as people have children, they send those children to college. And that's a whole other situation there, where the parents and the child become indebted to the government for educational loans. So the point at which the person becomes no longer useful to the government in terms of profit is the point at which between when their children leave college and when they retire, or more even precisely, if the person has a drug habit, at whatever point they get sober, they are of no further use to the government. And so, for many people, that sobriety age is somewhere in the 40 to 50 year age range. So in terms of life expectancy, the real goal then is to lower life expectancy somewhere in the 40 to 50 age range at which the person stops becoming a financial asset to the government. So what is a person to do? Is it hopeless? Of course not. Absolutely not. So what about hospice? Now, if you ask anybody, and people told me, Dr. Daniels, I'm so happy I should help with hospice. What would I do without hospice? What I would say is, as far as hospice goes, definitely limit your hospice use to somewhere around the 4 to 5 month mark. Somewhere in there, you need to either decide that your loved one is healthy enough to get out of hospice, or find some other situation. Maybe, I would say a nursing home, but that has its hazards too. So the best thing is to, one, leave hospice at the 4-month mark. But let's just say you can't do that. The family situation is such that you really need this help, this person's in hospice. What do you do? At about the 4 to 6 month mark, you need to stop accepting orders for medication. In other words, when a hospice nurse tells you give this drug, don't do it. And what will happen then is your loved one will live a lot longer. Now, they're going to live past the 6 month point, but at that point, what may or may not happen, or what will happen, the worst that could happen at that point is you'll have to find alternative financial sources. And so what the feds are doing now is they're making hospices stop providing services at that point or start charging the family directly. But you'd rather have that discussion than have a funeral. And so with the hospice, you can, that is easily handled situation by just not accepting the prescriptions, or should say not administering them. So don't administer any prescriptions after age 4 months that you weren't already using before 4 months. And so don't do that. Don't accept any dose increase. Well, what about the elderly who are dosed to death at the doctor's office? If you're elderly, I hate that word, but we'll just say over 65, then you need to understand that it takes 780 years of use to save one life with diabetes therapy. It takes 480 years of use to save one life with hypertensive therapy. It takes 1,250 years of use to save one life with cholesterol medications. So if you're taking medications for any of these things, you have to seriously question your ability to benefit from them. Chances are, if you're going to benefit, you already have. And chances are, if you've not benefited, you never will. So those are three classes of drugs immediately that one can question the use of those. And if you do insist on taking those, then I always say take at least half, if not a quarter, of the dose your doctor recommends. That's if you're determined to take those drugs. And any surgeries that you're offered to save your life, you'd probably be better off refusing them. That would be the thing. But you need to take control in terms of, if you're going to take drugs, then you decide, you are the worst person to decide on what dose you're going to take. And you decide on how much you're...
Okay. This is Dr. Gant. Hope you can hear me. That's the end of our regular discussion. I'm going to answer some questions now. So if you have questions, you can just click your box there. And what I'm going to do is read some questions that we've received, and we'll go over those. So the first question that we got was, if you do decide to go into hospice or the hospital, how can you say no to certain therapies once you enter? For example, if you think a drug might be dangerous for you or you don't want to take a higher dose, how do you say no? It turns out that once you enter the hospital is something called locum parentis. That means that the hospital is your parent and they call the shots. And you basically have all the rights of a 13-year-old or a rebellious teenager, basically. And so if you do protest, any protestation has to be pretty much underhanded. We're talking about refusing shots and cheeking the pills. You also have to inform your visitors, get some kind of agreement going, that your wishes will be honored. And they may have to go so far as to circle the bed and say, no, we're not taking any more. And ultimately, if things get too tense, where, you know, it becomes a threatening situation, you have to say, first of all, say you want to pray on it. That makes everyone stop. Then you have to say, I would like to sign out against medical advice. You have to say that. I would like to sign out against medical advice. Because once you say that, you are no longer a hospital patient. And you will just be shocked at how quickly the nurses will just jump up, run, get the paperwork, bring it to you, and fill it out for you. You'll sign it. They'll start unhooking all this crap that you probably didn't need in the first place. And you're out of there. The only danger is if some smart aleck orders a psychiatric consultation to commit you. And if your only insurance is Medicare, then this is unlikely to happen. But if the hospital knows that you have personal resources, then they are going to, they may try to get you to be committed and receive care against your wishes. The next question we have is, what can we do to take care of our elderly and feed them something besides Ensure? So what if you have an elderly loved one who appears to be ill and Ensure has been recommended and you know it's not really healthy and so you'd like to do something else? What can you do? Well, it turns out that Ensure has a lot of ingredients that are not very healthy. And the first ingredient, of course, is water. Second ingredient is sugar. It has artificial color, artificial flavoring. It has soy oil, which is not organic, which means it's genetically modified. So the list of ingredients is not really something you'd want to have your an elderly person especially drink. So what are you going to do? Well, first of all, if a person's able to swallow for you, you can treat them the same way you would treat any infant. In other words, you can feed them the same food that you eat, but just puree it first. And obviously your diet should be organic, non-GMO, as clean as you're able to make it. So what if they're not eating? What if they're really, you know, debilitated? Then you would give them bone broth. And bone broth is something you make. You just put bones in a pot, raw bones, and you put in enough water, you put with them garlic, onion, carrots, celery, with the celery leaves, important to put in the celery leaves, and some potato peels. The potato peels give them the potassium. And you cover the whole mix with water plus 1 inch. And then you let it cook overnight. In the morning, you strain it, let it cool, skim the fat off, and then you feed this to your loved one the same way you would feed Ensure. If the person's underweight, really sickly and skinny, then leave the fat on top and serve it warm. As far as what kind of bone broth to use, beef appears to be the most powerful, followed by pork, fish, and chicken in that order. So that would be the thing to give your less debilitated person. If you have someone who's usually in good shape and they just suddenly fell ill, or they're more chronically ill, let's say they've already lived 2 or 3 months in hospice, or you know, it looks like they're just going to be weakened forever, you want to give them juice from your juicer. I would recommend 6 carrots, 3 sticks of celery, and 1 beet. You just juice that, and you can. This will even fit into a feeding tube if you're working on a feeding tube. And what you do is give this person 1 bone broth meal with the fat if they're skinny, and 1 carrot meal. So I would give them the juice, the carrot, celery, beet juice in the morning, and the bone broth, say, in the afternoon. Obviously, this is not medical advice. Just my opinion, information only, use at your own risk. But that would be the thing to do. And in my book, Do You Have the Guts to Be Beautiful, I have a green drink recipe. That would be excellent. That would work for somebody who's able to drink. It might be a little bit thick to go down a feeding tube, and so you may want to either dilute it a lot or you might not be able to use it in your particular circumstance. So, let's see, what else, other question we have. Next one is, what about doctors? Are doctors being paid a lot of money to murder the elderly? Actually, I don't think so. I think that doctors are really just doing as they're told. Doctors are trained to, above all else, revere the standard of care. And so then, what doctors are told is that when you apply the standard of care, people are going to die. Some are going to make it, some are not. But if you don't do the standard of care, more will die than had you employed the standard of care. And so the doctors believe this. They believe that if they give the standard of care, that people are going to live and going to do well. So, and they're not very introspective. So, a big part of being a doctor, again, is working that 90 hours a week, not taking a look critically at what you do. And whatever goes wrong is always attributed to God, the patient disease, or patient noncompliant. And we even go so far as to be encouraged to think of the value of a person's life. Oh, this is a good person. It's too bad they had to die, but God did it for some reason. Or this is an awful person. It's too bad they had to die, but society is better off. And so people get in the, or doctors are trained to get in the habit of accepting the person's, the death of patients. And so it's not something that they question. Another question we got here is that we're trained to trust doctors and to trust Medicare and the government. And what are we going to do? What can we do to fix this, the Medicare program? I think that attitude is actually part of the problem. The problem is that people want someone else to accept responsibility and someone else to fix things. I think the problem is that you cannot accept having someone else, another entity like Medicare, be responsible for your health care, or in this case, the government be responsible for your pension. Because, let's think about this, where do they get their money from anyway? They get it from you, from your taxes, from your fees, from drug dealing, from making addicts of your children, creating a war zone out of your neighborhood. Far better to say, wait, time out, stop. I think I'll handle this obligation myself, rather than encourage a system where the government has a built-in financial incentive to murder you. So you have to say, hey, wait, I'm going to take responsibility. You know, I'm not going to rely on the government for all of this. Let me just check with one person. Hi, how are you? Is this William Witt? Hello? Hello, Yvonne, you're on the air? Hello? Man. I don't think I'm getting through very well here. Okay, if people have a question, they can click their question button. Oh, boy. And so another question that we have then is, what rights do patients have? Don't patients have the right to make a decision to refuse this therapy or this type of murderous intervention? And the answer is yes, but you can't go to the government, knock on your door and say, hey, do I have the right? Because what are they going to do? They're going to tell you, hey, you don't have the right. And so you have to take that right. And the way that you take that right is you simply start exercising these decisions. Yes, you're going to have some opposition. You're going to get intimidating letters from the hospital, intimidating letters from your doctors. Mm-hmm. Your doctors telling you that they can no longer accept responsibility for your health because you didn't get your screening exam or whatever. But these are just intimidating feedback and just a paper tiger, nothing to pay attention to. So next week, our topic is your children, the harvesting of your children. And what I'm going to talk about is the detention center program where children are detained and often drugged. So I'm going to have as my special guest next week people who can talk to us about this. Okay, well, thank you very much. This is the end of Healing with Dr. Daniels, Dosing the Elderly.